Good evening, everyone. Our guest speaker this evening is Chaver Knesset, Rabbi Dov Lipman. And, you know, we're deep in the middle of summer, so many people away on vacation. In fact, I'm on vacation, but I emerged from my secure, undisclosed location for this very important event. I first heard of Rabbi Lipman as he was running for the Knesset not long ago, and then last year at the Rabbinical Conference, the RCA, Rabbinical Council of America Conference, I had an opportunity to actually hear Rabbi Lipman in person, and I was very moved by his presentation, his story, and his thoughts about many important issues that are facing Israel today, that I immediately approached him and invited him to come speak at Kingsway. And he said, sure. And, you know, and at the time he was a relatively new politician, so I believed him. But, you know, then time went on, and there are only so many times, you know, you can, you know, the girl can say, you know, call me back, and, you know, then you think that, you know, you move on. So I'd spoken to Rabbi Lipman's office several times, and, you know, I moved on. But Rabbi Lipman is, despite the fact that he is now a seasoned politician, he's a man of integrity, because without prompting, he reached out to me a couple of weeks ago, just before Tisha B'Av, and said, you know, he's in town, and he would love to come to Kingsway Jewish Center. So it is really a delight for me to be able to present Rabbi Lipman, and without any further ado, Chaver Knesset, Rabbi Dov Lipman. Just one other word of introduction. We had the opportunity to meet Rabbi Lipman earlier this week at the Chasana of the Strausses are right here, okay. At their daughter's Chasana this week, where Rabbi Lipman was a Masadar Kedushin. So mazel tov to us all.
Thank you. Is this on, by the way? Or? Okay. It's not on, right?
It looks good.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think so.
Ready, Nautilus? Okay.
Thank you so much. The truth is, just by way of background, that I actually wasn't supposed to be here tonight. This wasn't something which was planned well in advance. Essentially, for over a year within my family, we were planning to have a period of time where we could actually visit our relatives, my grandmother in New York, my sisters in Baltimore, Silver Spring, and we figured this would be a good time. The Knesset is officially on recess during the month of August, so we thought that we would turn this time. Our kids are finishing camp, and this would be a good time to be in the States and to make this trip happen. But then as the summer started coming around and the mood in Israel changed a little bit in terms of what was happening, I actually decided that I wasn't going to come in. My place is in Israel, especially when we're having struggles and we're having difficulty. And the assumption was that we weren't going to come in. And then, without getting into all the details, it was actually decided on a Knesset level that I would come to the States, do a series of media interviews, meetings, Capitol Hill, and the like, do a little bit of a family vacation, but also really try to reach out to the communities and try to share a little in terms of what's happening in Israel. And therefore, I looked at our list of places that I had said that I would certainly try to come to, and we made contact with the rabbi, and it's a real honor to be here. It's hard to be here. 30,000 people were at Kikar Rabin in Tel Aviv tonight demonstrating, demanding that the government continue to ensure its safety, and certainly my mind is there, and I have my app, which tells me every time a missile is shot into Israel. But it's still important to be here, and it's important to be involved with the broader Jewish community as well, and to update everyone in terms of what's happening. But before I get to the current summer, I'm going to take a step back and go back actually 10 years. In July 2004, my wife and my four children, we made the trek up the turnpike from Silver Spring, Maryland, had this very teary goodbye with my in-laws in JFK, where I literally felt like I was extracting my children from their grandparents. And we got onto the plane. It was the second Nefesh B'Nefesh charter flight. And everyone on this plane is moving to Israel together. And we're getting our children settled, and the pilot started speaking to us from the cockpit, and he gave some information about the flight. And at the very end, he said, "Everybody sit back, relax, and enjoy the flight. I'm here to take you home." And he said that, and somehow in the entire process of our preparing to make Aliyah, I hadn't thought about it just exactly the way he said it. He just said it the way it was. That after 2,000 years of my family, my wife's family, going from continent to continent, from country to country, and in every single one of them, except for the United States, and I'll talk about that in a few moments, in every single one of them, we ended up either running away or being chased out. Here we were, by choice, deciding that we were going to return to the homeland. Okay. And that statement of "we're here to come back home, I'm here to take you home," has stuck with me every single moment since we moved to Israel. I did not move to Israel with intent to get into politics. We moved to the city of Beit Shemesh. I don't know if it's humorous or sad in terms of the reason why we chose Beit Shemesh, but I was there on a pilot trip a few months before, and we were driving around different places, and I was visiting Beit Shemesh, and I saw in Beit Shemesh there were so many different populations living together. You have the Haredi community, you have the secular community, Russians, Ethiopians, English speakers, all different backgrounds. And I called my wife, who was here in America, and I said, "We have to move to Beit Shemesh to show our children how Jews of all different types can live together in harmony and get along with one another. And this is the dream of the ingathering of the exiles." And I learned very quickly in Beit Shemesh that that wasn't the case. That it wasn't the case. We moved to a country which was 56 years old at the time. Nothing short of a miracle in terms of what has been built through blood, sweat, and tears, with infrastructure, with everything that we needed. And this country was handed to us on a silver platter. There's one thing that we haven't figured out how to get right. And that is, how do you take Jews from 2,000 years of different national experiences, cultural experiences, religious experiences, put them in this small little area that we call Israel, and get along? That's what we haven't figured out how to do. And I certainly experienced that in Beit Shemesh in a very real way, very firsthand. But Beit Shemesh, on a certain level, is a microcosm of the entire country. So I started getting involved. Just actually, my first step was, I figured, I come from yeshiva background, I understand where the Torah world is coming from in Israel, and maybe I can be, you know, I came with this American, you know, can't we all just get along approach, and I'll be a mediator between these groups, and I'll solve all the world's problems. And I failed miserably. And in the process of failing miserably, I actually learned about the depth of some of these issues. These are not just some superficial issues on the streets of Beit Shemesh. These are issues that go to the core of the identity of Israel. Israel calls itself a Jewish and democratic state. And that was written down very quickly in May 1948, and nobody took the time to define what does that mean. And I would suggest that if you polled the 109 Jewish members of Knesset and asked them, "What does a Jewish state mean to you?" you could very likely get 109 different answers. And that certainly represents broader Israel. And then when you add to that Jewish and democratic, right, you could bang your head against the wall for hours trying to figure out how does that work. Right, here in the United States, we say separation of church and state. And of course, religion impacts. It impacts how politicians make their decisions, but officially there's a break. But in Israel, we don't want there to be a clean break. We want to be building a Jewish state. And the question is, How do you build that Jewish state? What's the best way to go about it? And what I learned in Beit Shemesh, and obviously in Beit Shemesh, it was a very extreme, extreme situation. The people who made headlines and made trouble in Beit Shemesh, the small minority of a minority of a minority, and it's always important to emphasize that, because sometimes you hear this terminology, Haredim, and people like paint these broad strokes, and the average Haredi Jew that you meet in Israel is not someone who is ever going to attack anyone, not someone who's going to be coercive towards anyone. They're people who live very value-centered lives, very involved in chesed, and unfortunately that doesn't get enough press, but it's always important to make that statement. I believe, and I've learned over the last year and a half, and I'll get to that in a moment, that politically, they're not necessarily represented in the right way, but it's important when we talk about these stories that it be very clear. But I saw some pretty horrible things, and I saw what could happen when the idea of building a Jewish state, the way people envision it, how it could become coercive, how it can actually become violent, and even worse, how much it can push away the rest of the country. I've been traveling around Israel now for two and a half years, meeting with different groups, and I've heard from secular Jews in Israel, especially young people, the following two sentences. The first sentence is, I hate Judaism. Think about this for a moment. After 2,000 years, we've returned home, we're building our own state, and young Jews en masse say, I hate Judaism. But there's a second half to it. And they then say, and I hate that I hate Judaism. Meaning these are not people, young people who are looking for a way out. They're not looking to be rebellious. It's not that they don't want it. They want to be proud Jews in a Jewish state. But we, on the religious side, have done a poor job in bringing them in. And we've done too good a job, unfortunately, in being coercive in nature. And I tell every group that I speak to, I grew up in a religious home. I have smicha from Neri Israel in Baltimore. I believe what I believe with passion. I've written about it. I speak about it. But I also believe that I have no right to force what I believe on somebody else. And that was the starting point towards looking into getting involved in politics. Because I realized, as we experienced what we were experiencing in Beit Shemesh, and I would turn to all kinds of political leaders to get involved, I learned very quickly that I wasn't going to be successful. Why? Because of politics. Because of the need to have a coalition for a government to be sustained, and where there has to be the Haredi parties involved. The Haredi political parties tend to represent a little bit more extreme version than the Haredi street, and nobody wanted to get involved. Nobody wanted to help citizens of Beit Shemesh because of politics. And that's when I said, I have to get involved in politics. I love teaching. I miss teaching. A proud student of mine, Yosef Seawald, is sitting right over here. I'm proud to say that I was a Rebbe of such a wonderful young man. I love teaching. But I have to make a shift here because there's something rotten in terms of the way Torah and the way even the yeshiva world, from my perspective, was being represented in Israel. And that is having a major negative effect on the rest of Israel. And thousands and thousands of secular Jews are not interested. They are interested, but not interested in what we were presenting to them. So I began to look to get involved in politics. I have to be honest with you. I never would have imagined that I could be a member of Knesset. Hebrew-wise, I didn't think there was any possibility of it being up to par. And also the culture I saw on the TV, and the Knesset people yell at each other and scream at each other, and I'm this quiet American boy who raises my hand and says, please. So I wasn't really thinking about being a member of Knesset. I just wanted to be involved in the process. And I looked around, and in Israel, you can't just say, I want to run for politics. You have to be in a party. And I really didn't see. I dabbled with one party for a while, and it wasn't really the vision of unity, of breaking down barriers that I wanted to be part of. And I figured at that point, that's it. There's no political home. There's no place where I can really work for this. And I'll just focus on Beit Shemesh. That's what I figured would happen. The last name that would have ever occurred to me in terms of getting involved politically in Israel was Yair Lapid. All I had heard about Yair Lapid was negative. I didn't know him. I heard negative. I heard that Yair was anti-Charedi, he's anti-Torah, he's anti-religious, he's anti-Semitic. These are the things that you hear. So it didn't even occur to me. And then a friend of mine sent me a speech that Yair gave to Charedim. It's Yair Lapid at Kiryat Ono. And he spoke to Charedim. And he speaks to these Charedim, and he said, when the State of Israel was founded, there was a battle, over what kind of country we were going to have. The secular founders of Israel wanted to have a secular state, devoid of Torah, devoid of mitzvot, even to some devoid of God. That's what they wanted. And the religious Zionists and the Charedim said no. Right, we're returning to our homeland, our biblical homeland, that has to be based on God and based on Torah and based on the Tanakh. And there was a battle. And Yair Lapid looks at Yair Lapid, who was presented to me always as this secular icon in Israel who represented a very secular ideology, he looked at this group of Charedim, young men, in Kiryat Ono, and he said two words in Hebrew. He said, Atem Nitzachtem. You won. You won. That battle is over. You won. There is God in Israel, there is Torah, there is mitzvah observance, and we, as secular Jews, aren't fighting against that. All we're asking you is not to force us. Don't coerce us. Let's live together. Let's live to be tolerant of each other. And don't be coercive towards us. And let's work together. Take responsibility and let's work together. And in my mind's eye, as I heard him speaking, I saw this hand coming out from the secular side. And I wanted to be one of the people that grabbed the other side of that hand. This is what I was waiting for, a moment where secular leadership is saying they want to work together with religious Jews. I want to be part of that. So what do you do? I mean, I want to be part of that. That's very nice. I'm just a guy who made Aliyah 8 years before. So I went on Google, and I found this lapidteam@gmail.com, and I sent an email off saying, this is my story. I'd love to be involved. I'd love to help. I believe very much in what you're saying, and I figured that would be it. Maybe similar to the rabbi asking me to speak and my saying yes, I figured, okay, I sent off my email. A few weeks later, I heard back. Thank you. Thank you so much. A few weeks later, much easier my voice also, thank you. A few weeks later, I heard back from Yair's office. It was three people working out of a back law office in Tel Aviv. I went, I met with them. I said, I'll be happy to arrange an event for Yair and Beit Shemesh. And to make a very long story short, about 2 months later, I was sitting for the first time together with Yair. And we're sitting together, just the two of us, very quietly. And about 5 minutes into the conversation, I had a very sad thought. And my thought was, I've been living in Israel for 8 years, and this is the first time that I was having a conversation of substance with a secular Jew in Israel about what do we want out of this country. First time. I'm a friendly guy. I say good morning. I say Boker Tov. I say Shabbat Shalom. I have people over. But to talk about what do we want here, this was the first time. And that's a tragedy. Because there's no way we'll ever be able to work things out if it's always religious against secular. And if it's not, let's sit together and try to figure out a way to make this work. We talked for about an hour. We talked about very personal things over the course of that hour. His father had passed away just a few years before, and he talked about the impact, thank you, that had on his life. My father had passed away a few years before, and I talked about the impact it has on me on a daily basis. And at the end of the hour, Yair turned to me and he said, Dov, he said, we come from different planets. Right, you're an Orthodox boy from Silver Spring, Maryland. I come from an aristocratic secular family in Tel Aviv. But we just sat together for an hour, and we agree about 80% of the issues. We disagree about 20%, and in some cases, very strongly. Let's work together on those 80%. And on the 20%, instead of it being us against them, instead of battling with one another, let's sit together around the table and try to find compromise and try to find understandings. And it's not going to be easy. It's not always going to be comfortable. We might get into heated debates. but at least we'll be able to find a way to work together here. And I said, Yair, this is music to my ears. This is what I believe. I believe this is the number one challenge in Israel today, is to work out these issues in a proper way. I'm interested in being on board. A few months later, he offered for me to be number 17 on the list for Knesset. When we met the time, it wasn't about serving in the Knesset. It was just about working together. And I accepted. I told him, I accept it with honor. I'm only in the country 8 years and you're offering me to run for Knesset. I said, it's not realistic at all. The polls had Yesh Atid, the new party that he was starting, somewhere around 9 seats or 10 seats at best. But I said, it's an honor. He said, no, you're going to be in. I said, yeah, you don't have to say that. It's okay. I really want to be involved, especially the issues regarding the Haredim. I think it's important that there be a voice representing sort of the Torah side within the party. But he said, you'll see. And sure enough, a pretty wonderful thing happened along the way. And this party started gelling together, where it was very different than other parties that have been started in Israel. It was started from zero. The idea was to bring in people who are outside of the Knesset, giving up other careers to be involved. Yair reached out and named as the number two in his party, which has tremendous meaning, religious rabbi, Rabbi Shai Peron, who's now the education minister. Rabbi Peron was destroyed in the religious press. How are you the number two in Yair Lapid's party? Isn't that uncomfortable? Isn't that hard? And his answer was, yeah, it's not comfortable and it's hard, but that's the challenge of our time, is to work together. And Yair, the secular press, a religious rabbi, he's got his tzitzis flying out as the number two in your party? What kind of a... This is not the Yair Lapid that we were hoping for the secular community in Israel. And Yair said, this is what we're building over here. We're building something different. And throughout the entire list, people coming from outside of politics to get involved from all different backgrounds. 8 out of the top 16 were females, the first time in Israel's history that there was that percentage of female representation. Sephardic, Ashkenazic, secular, religious, all coming together to work and try to deal with internal issues primarily in Israel. And amazingly, Yair understood that Israelis were looking internally. You know, for 30, 40 years, we've been fighting about left-wing versus right-wing, and we're pretty much in the same place that we were. And I'm not saying we don't have to deal with those issues. We do. But Israelis were thinking about the economy and education and internal issues and making their lives better. And that's what we very much were coming to with our campaign. Americans get a kick out of this. Our campaign slogan was Banu Lashanot, we've come to make change. So that certainly resonates with American politics as well. And we were there on election night and we had won 19 seats. And all of a sudden, we were celebrating a victory. And the next morning, I can tell you, I woke up with a feeling of responsibility that hasn't really left, which is hard to describe. It's hard to describe. All of a sudden, you've been going around the country talking about a vision, talking about religion and state issues, which is my issue primarily, and finding ways to break down barriers. And now all of a sudden, here we are. We've been elected. People, over 500,000 people voted for us and expected us to follow through. And there was a tremendous feeling of responsibility. We got to work very quickly on our platform on how to build the laws, especially the draft of the Haredim, which was a flag issue and one which I took very seriously, and education reform and other things as well. And just how do you build those as legislation instead of it just being theory in a campaign? I actually had to give up my American citizenship. I got a letter 2 weeks before the inauguration saying that Israeli law requires me to give up my dual citizenship. It was myself. Naftali Bennett also had to do it. Naftali didn't grow up in America, so it wasn't so hard for him. It wasn't hard to make the decision, but it was hard to do it. I went to the embassy, I opened it at a special time, they asked me to raise my right hand and say, I hereby renounce. I actually started tearing up. What an amazing country that gave my father's side of the family safe haven from pogroms in Russia in the late 19th century, my mother's side of the family after the Holocaust. And every opportunity was open to me here. And I felt like lack of a karat hatov. I felt like I was an ingrate by saying these words. I actually, after it was done, we got through it, I actually sat down and I wrote this letter. I didn't know what to do with it. I just felt so bad. And I gave it to the ambassador I went up to see him and I said, if you could please give this to the president. I don't know if that's the right way to do it, but and it was basically thanking America for giving me so much. I don't know how it happened, but Fox News got hold of it, and they called me and I was able to do an interview about it, which is actually gave me a platform to actually thank America in a way which I wasn't expecting to have, and the video is out there. But I will tell you that a few hours later I was thinking about it, and there was something, even though on a certain level it's just semantics and paperwork, there was something about coming full circle and being Israeli. Just the idea of our country, you know, we left from Israel, we went around the world, made our different stops, and here I am, I'm back, and my citizenship is purely Israeli. We entered the Knesset. The very first thing that I did upon entering the Knesset was I started a task force to help Haredim get to work. Help Haredim get to work. And there were a few reasons for that. The first reason was plain and simple. People are living in poverty, and they don't have the tools, even if they want to go out to work. To get to work, how do I find a job? Where do I find a job? How do I get trained for that job? So that was step one, just to help people leave poverty. But number two, I learned, especially in Beit Shemesh, that when talking about religion and state issues in general, and the more extreme version of Haredi Judaism, which has been creeping out little by little over the years, that comes because of the isolationism. You have a community which is isolated from the rest of Israel, not having a general education, not part of the military or national service, not part of the workforce, not involved. That isolation breeds the extremism. The moment Haredim go to work, the moment they go to work, they all of a sudden realize that broader Israel is not, excuse the expression, is not the devil, is not Satan, as many of them told me that they've been told that the rest of Israel is, that these are secular people, but they're not out to make them less religious, and they can get along with them. And then secular Israelis see that Haredim are great people, many who have been, like I said before, volunteering for a long time in all kinds of chesed organizations and wonderful value-centered people who are just brought up in a different way. And it creates this bridge which doesn't exist any other place for those two communities to meet in Israel. And the third level is certainly economic, and that is just looking towards Israel's future. If you have a Haredi community, which now numbers 800,000, a tenth of the population, but is having far more children than the rest of Israel, thank God that Jewish children are being born. But if a community as an ideology doesn't have an education, doesn't go to work, if you look towards the future, it's a catastrophe economically for Israel. So for a variety of reasons, I set to work on this, and thank God, I can look back over a year and a half, and we have thousands and thousands of young men. I'm saying young men not because I'm against the women going to work. The women were already going to work. And in fact, the women actually had a lot of the burden of the responsibility for their families, and that's to ease that as well a little bit. We have thousands of guys going to work. And the moment they were presented with the opportunity to do so, and we do advertising in all the Haredi websites, and we have other ways of getting to them, the opportunity to go to work, they'll do it. And that's been a tremendous success. And what CEOs have reported back to me, and they've said, not only has it been nice for them to do something and try to hire Haredim, they said that the Haredim very often end up being their best employees. You're talking about young men who are very disciplined, they know how to use their minds, they've been sitting and learning, and all of a sudden there's creativity, and they have new ideas, and especially in high tech in particular, they love hiring Haredim. So hopefully we're onto something here, and that trend will continue. We were able to pass, thank God, the draft law, which was probably covered here as falsely as it was in other places. No one's going into any yeshiva to arrest anybody for not serving in the army, which, by the way, the young Haredi boys were told was going to happen. When I met with them, or people saw me or accosted me in the streets, that's what they thought was going to happen. That here we are, evil people coming to pull them out of the Beis Medrash and bring them to jail. The law is very straightforward. It basically sets goals per year. Goals per year, between the ages of 18 and 24, there are 55,000 Haredi young men in those ages. 55,000. And we set goals per year. How many should serve in the army? How many national service? The goals are way below the number of guys who aren't really learning day and night. We met with rabbis, we met with Rosh Yeshiva, we got a sense for what's happening. Way below it, but we wanted to start in a reasonable way, and that's what the law says. And as long as those goals are being met, and the goals were already met for 2014, they will be met in the future years, then things continue. But the idea is to increase per year the number of guys that are learning, and the idea is to get to a point where guys who aren't really learning day and night, if they aren't really learning day and night, then they should, after a few years in yeshiva, it's time to enter the world, and that's through service, and that's through going to school, and that's through going to work. The guys who are really learning day and night, yoma v'layla, torato umnato, this is all they want to do. For the first time in the history of Israel, the law doesn't say that they're exempt from serving. The law says that their learning is their service. And Yair Lapid, who people love to hate on the religious side, Yair Lapid, he's on video saying that for him is one of the greatest merits that he has. That learning Torah is not something where you're exempt, you're not outside the fold, we're all one nation, and that's your service. And that's a very important statement in the law as well. The last step of the law, which very few people know about, which is something which I really pushed for, is that the law says that anybody who right now is 22 or over, okay, it's 30,000, a little bit more than 30, about 30,000 guys in the draft age, they get amnesty, and they're free to go to work. Because until now, if you didn't serve in the army, you were not legally allowed to go to work until you were close to 30 years old. So guys just stayed trapped in the system. They weren't in yeshiva or kolel because this was their passion, but they had nowhere else to go. They can't go serve, they can't go work, so they sat. And now they're getting letters saying they are allowed to leave. The letter actually gives them some instructions where they can turn to, some of our programs, some other programs, to help them get to work. So that for sure, from my perspective, looking back on this year and a half, and my goal of trying to ease the Haredi community towards broader Israel and create a community which I experienced here, going to Ner Yisrael, where all of my friends are scholars on the highest of levels, they're fervently committed religiously, but they're also doctors and they're lawyers and they're accountants and they're high-tech entrepreneurs, to try to begin the process of that starting in Israel. It's going to be a long way, but to start that process. So that's the draft law, that's the guys going to work. We're very hard at work on religion and state issues. Again, it's very, very delicate and very, very sensitive. But just to give you one example, marriage in Israel. That's an issue wherever I traveled, especially from secular Israelis, this was the issue. Where they live secular lives, and all of a sudden, they come to this great moment in their lives, and they're forced into a track which means nothing to them, for the most part is very stringent in nature, and as a result, 9,000 couples per year go to other places, go to Cyprus, to get a civil marriage, and they come back in Israel and live with their civil marriage they got in Cyprus. I'll take this a step further for a moment, though, since we're in an Orthodox synagogue. There's actually, from the religious side, a problem with forcing people to get married. Kedat Moshe Yisrael, I had the privilege this past Sunday of being Mesadar Kedushin at Sarah and Shui's wedding. Right? They got married Kedat Moshe Yisrael, and now they're bound together in Halacha. And if they veer from that, right, we're not only talking about Eshet Ish, but if children are born from other relationships, now we're talking about mamzerut. We're talking about children that are being born, which in halacha are defined as bastard children, which has all kinds of horrific halachic ramifications. When we take secular Israelis who have no interest in religion whatsoever, and we force them under a chuppah, and we force them to get married halachically, and they have no interest in living a halachic lifestyle, when they decide to leave from each other, which unfortunately is far too high a percentage, they don't even bother going to the Rabbanut to get a divorce. Who wants to bother with that? And they just separate from each other, and they meet new people, and they start living together, and children are born. So by being so strict and saying, we want to force everyone to get married halachically, we're actually creating halachic problems. And therefore, we sat down to find a solution. And by the way, I mean, I'm being blasted for being involved in this in the press, in the religious press in Israel. Rav Avadia Yosef, of blessed memory, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, used to tell his students, if you're being Mesader Kiddushin, If you're running a wedding and you sense that the Chatan and Kala are not interested in living a halachic lifestyle, brace yourselves for this. He said, make sure the witnesses are not kosher witnesses, so that they're not married halachically. So the innovator of civil marriage in Israel was a Rav Avadia Yosef Zatzal, because he understood this issue. So we sat down together and we said, what do we do? What will we do? What kind of a solution can we find? I don't want to get rid of the idea that marriage in Judaism is religious in nature and spiritual. For thousands of years, that's what we've been. And we want to create a Jewish state. On the other hand, we have a democratic state. So we in our party sat down. It was five of us. It was myself, Rabbi Shai Peron, the education minister, Aliza Lavi, who's also religious, and she actually works very hard on women's issues, Ruth Calderon, who many of you might have heard of, who got up in her inaugural speech and gave a Talmudic lecture to the Knesset, and Yael German, who's now the health minister. Five of us from very different backgrounds. We worked together for months, and we came up with an idea which is sounds simple. I'll just say it in just two lines. It's not civil marriages, but civil unions. If someone in Israel wants to have a marriage, marriage has always been spiritual, it's been religious, it's through the Rabbanut, a Rabbanut that has to be more embracing and more open, but that's marriage. But you live in a democratic country, you're entitled to your rights, so there's something, it's just a civil contract for two people called a civil union. And it's the union starts with the contract, it ends with the contract, that's how it is. And that's what we've created, and that's the law that we're working on right now. We have most of the coalition on board, just a few people in Bayit Hadid that we have to work with, and then hopefully we'll be able to move forward. But that's just an idea. And by the way, when broader Israel hears about this law, you can almost hear the collective sigh. Thank you. And many people, by the way, say that many people will choose the marriage, but it'll be a choice. You're giving me a choice, right? We all know, and Chazal teaches this, that the moment you're forced to do something, right, you recoil, you go the other way. I have a choice. There's a Rabbanut, which is more open, which, by the way, is already more open. We passed a law that you could choose any rabbi in the Rabbanut that you want, because until now you've been forced, wherever you live, to follow that rabbi. Now you can choose anyone. So yeah, people are shopping around, which is a good thing for a rabbi who they'll feel comfortable with. And that will explain to them what's happening when they're getting married to the Rabbanut instead of it just being some kind of a formality. So we're moving forward on religion and state issues. We have some laws that are about to pass regarding the Agunah issue in Israel, which will also... Again, by the way, these were issues we could not deal with for decades, because a decision was made actually before the election between Yair Lapid, who's now the finance minister, the chairman of our party, and Naftali Bennett, now the economic minister, who's the chairman of Bayit Hayudi, that if the numbers work out, they will create a government without the Haredi parties. Not because anybody hates Haredim, not because anybody's anti-Haredi, but in the Israeli government, if you have a minister in the government, a minister can basically veto any bill that he wants. So if the Haredim are in the government, they will stop any movement on any of these issues like they've done for decades. And therefore they have to be outside the government, they're in the Knesset, but they have to be outside the government so that we can move forward with all of these laws, and thank God we've been doing so. So all of these internal issues we've been addressing, and it's not always easy. You do still have a coalition that you have to work with, and we're trying to make progress. And I look back on a year and a half, and it's been remarkable. It's been remarkable in terms of the changes that you can see on the ground. We also, by the way, took away funding from yeshivot, that not full funding. We took about some of the funding that don't have general studies, but we promised full funding to any yeshiva which has general studies, basic general studies. And this wasn't in the headlines because that was the deal, but the Shas, entire Shas education network, accepted that. And they now have basic general studies with education ministry oversight, basic math, basic English, and the like, to give them the skills that one day they can actually go to work. And there are three or more yeshiva high schools in the Lithuanian side. Very courageous Rashi yeshiva who said, we're in. And they're having basic... I visited one of them a few months ago in Yerushalayim, and I met with two of the young boys. One is from Bnei Brak and one is from Beitar. And they're so happy. And I asked them, what are they happy about? One of them said, I walk around the streets and I read the signs in English now. And there's a whole new world that's open to me. And the other one said, I always loved soccer, but I was never allowed to play soccer. And now we have a few times a week we play soccer. And he said to me, that makes my davening better, and that makes my learning better. So we're on to something here. And God willing, this will continue. You know, we say in yeshiva sometimes, bitulo zuhikiyumo, right? Saying that you're not going to learn Torah all day long as the only thing you do, and you'll do something else, that actually strengthens your learning of Torah and strengthens you spiritually. So little by little, step by step, we're moving on these issues. Certainly, a sense in the secular community that something is happening in a positive way. We have a law about conversion, which was unfortunately stopped, but it will become government policy to basically create a scenario where there are a few hundred thousand Russians that came to Israel that are in a category called Zerei Yisrael. They're not coming from nowhere. Their father was Jewish or their grandfather was Jewish. They want part of the Jewish people and create a halachic scenario where they can also become part of the Jewish people instead of sitting back quietly, letting non-Jews live in Israel and create a scenario of intermarriage that we can't even imagine what's going to be in 20, 30 years as their children meet our children with the Hebrew names, living in Israel, going to our universities, serving in the army, and create a scenario we solve that problem as well. We were hard at work getting ready for the summer session and then preparing for the fall session when all of a sudden everything came to a screeching halt. On a Friday, early Friday morning, I got a message saying that it seems that three boys have been kidnapped. We were asked to stay quiet about it, but it seems to be a tough situation. I was then sitting at my son's baseball game on Friday afternoon, and I got a message saying in a joint operation of elite combat units and the Shabak, the three boys were rescued and the terrorists were killed and all is good. And I turned around to everybody around me and I said, you're not going to believe what happened today. And I told them the wonderful news that despite three boys being kidnapped, they've been saved. And then 15 minutes later, I got a message saying, ignore that message. That was not from a source that was reliable. And all of a sudden, everything they're working on, which is important, came to a screeching halt. And all of Israel, to be honest with you, came to a screeching halt. There was something about that story. We've gone through kidnappings before. We've gone through wars before. And I'm not an experienced Israeli. I'm only there 10 years. People who have been there their whole lives told me there was never any feeling like this before of children just snatched off the street. Never happened before. And what's interesting was we were talking about religious boys. Not just religious boys who were going to yeshiva in over the Green Line. And to be honest with you, there was instantaneously a unity and a unity of purpose that we've never felt before. In the Knesset itself, we had a tefillah for the chayalim, for the boys, and people came who I never would have imagined would be davening, and they were there as part of it as well. Even within our party, I saw something very special happening. It's very interesting. Yair Lapid, he developed this connection with the Shire family, a very close connection. And they actually asked him, he asked them, what can I do for you? What can I do for you? Gilad's parents. And they said, it would mean a lot to us if you prayed, if you davened. And Yair went home, and I won't get to all of his theology right now. We talk about it all the time. He believes in God. He believes in God's involvement in the world. He does talk to God and communicate with God, but sitting down with a sitter and going through davening is not part of his lifestyle. He went home. He found his grandfather's sitter, and he went through all of davening. And just amazing things were happening. And there was a real feeling of unity and hope. We had a strong indication that the scenario wasn't so rosy. The audio tape, which was heard very early on, definitely indicated that there were gunshots in that car just a few minutes after they were taken. But you always hope for the best. And there we were on this amazing night in Tel Aviv. The parents worked together with other groups to create a rally. And Kikar Rabin, Rabin Square in Tel Aviv, is a place where when all of Israel is coming out for something, it's filled. Right? When the peace camp is coming out, it's filled. When people who are more right-wing come out, it's filled. When Maccabi Tel Aviv wins the European Cup, it's filled. And I was so nervous that it wasn't going to be filled. I was nervous that we're coming to this rally for these boys. It was during the World Cup. Maybe people will be watching the game. I don't know what. And boy, was it filled. And it was filled with people from all backgrounds. And I had the honor of sitting with the parents. And for a few weeks, the parents had lifted up the country. It's almost as if God handpicked these parents. And now the country was giving back to them. And they were very much uplifted as well. And less than 24 hours later, we got the news that the bodies were found. And less than 24 hours after that, I was sitting just a few feet away from these three bodies wrapped in Israeli flags. And I remember saying to myself, God, let this be the worst funeral I ever attend in my life, to see this scene. And we went through the shivas, and all of a sudden the situation with Gaza starts escalating. And here again, the country really, really in a remarkable way, with a unity of purpose, I'll say in a very responsible way, the Prime Minister is not in our party, Yair is in the security cabinet, but I have to praise everyone involved in a very methodical, logical, thought-out way, dealing with an impossible situation. An impossible situation. Because it's very easy to come out and say, go in, take over Gaza, get rid of Hamas, but then you start reading the analysis of how many soldiers we would not only lose in the process, but how many are presumed to be kidnapped alive in the process. And you start understanding, and then what happens the next day? It's complicated. So we can hit them hard. We set a goal of get rid of these tunnels, which I have to tell you, there is no greater fear in the world than the possibility of a tunnel all of a sudden appearing. We saw how that works. So we said we're getting rid of those. For that to be done, you have to have soldiers on the ground. And then all of a sudden, my daily schedule changed. And instead of my schedule being committee hearings, votes, and the like, my schedule was funeral, hospital visit, shiva. And that's what we did. That's what we did. And I saw, and I won't go over it now, leading up to Tisha B'Av, I talked about it a little bit more, but now we're in the weeks of Nachamu, of comfort, so I don't have to rehash all of this. But it was horrific. It was horrific on a daily basis to see the degree of suffering and sadness, and to see these princes that were taken from us in such a just battle. And I was out there doing press. For some reason, they like sending me to the BBC, which is not fun. And in the world, we can try our best, we can explain it as best we can. They're not gonna embrace us. I was very clear in many cases, and I said that there's such a lack of intellectual honesty that there's no other way to explain it but anti-Semitism. And I was slammed for saying that, but I'll continue saying it. And we'll continue arguing our case and explaining it. And we were, from the beginning, we said, a ceasefire, we can take care of the tunnels, not continue firing, we'll do so. We are sad about every civilian life that's killed in Gaza, and it's true. In every single attack that's okayed, there's a lawyer. There's a lawyer that's attached to okay it and say that it doesn't violate the international laws. That's how careful we are. There's no country in the world. I sat in an interview together with, I'm forgetting his name right now, it'll come to me, but he was the chief general for the British army in Afghanistan, Richard Kemp. And he said there's no army in the world that goes to the lengths that we go through, and we're very proud of that. Because that also goes to what kind of country are we fighting for, and what kind of society are we trying to build. So we're right now in this sort of in-between mode, where there's a little bit of a waiting game, and we're buying a little bit of breathing space for the people in the south, and we have a commitment that we will not let a situation continue where these, you know, they call them, I'm forgetting my English here, but that it just drips. They call them drips of missiles that come in. The drips of missiles are not acceptable. No country in the world would allow that to happen. No country in the world would rest while that's happening, and we will continue to hit them every time they shoot at us, and hopefully take advantage of the opportunity that we have, where we have an Egypt, which is no greater friend of Hamas either, where we have a Saudi Arabia, which is sort of quietly pushing us as well, and there is a window of opportunity. I will add the fact that all of a sudden the United States is now engaged somewhat in Iraq, dealing with the same group. We give different names to them, but it's the same group that wants to see an Islamic world, let's be frank. And all of a sudden the United States will eventually realize that they can't solve the problem from the air. And I already have congressmen telling me that there are discussions about do they have to bring in ground troops, and there might already be ground troops. But they just don't want to announce that they're there. And that might also help Israel from an international perspective. But when it's all said and done, we have ourselves to care for ourselves. And we've really learned that over these last number of weeks. And we've also realized the power of a unified Israeli public. There are billboards all over Israel, and people, again, I've only been there 10 years, have told me that never happened before in any war, about how proud we are, welcoming the soldiers back as heroes, mission accomplished, wow, you saved us from these tunnels. Unbelievable. I can tell you the lone soldiers, there were two soldiers that were killed, Sean Carmelli from Texas and Max Steinberg from Los Angeles. Sean Carmelli's funeral, 11th night in Haifa, 20,000 people didn't know him, came to show their love for a soldier from America. People couldn't get there because all the exits were flooded. The next few days later, I was honored with giving a eulogy for Max Steinberg on Har Herzl in Yerushalayim. 35,000 people. Unbelievable outpouring of love. By the way, just this past Monday morning, I was at JFK for a send-off of 108 Americans who are going to serve in the IDF as lone soldiers. Unbelievable. But Israel is unified, and our challenge is going to be, I'll put the military issues aside for the moment and the political aside during the questions, I have no problem answering them. Our challenge is going to be to maintain that unity afterwards. It's never going to be 100%, but to try to find a way to tap into that feeling. That's why I got involved in politics, to be very frank with you, because from my perspective, the solution to all these issues is our breaking down barriers and unifying together as a people. That is ultimately what we have to do, and that's what we'll keep doing. And I will continue working on it. We in Yesh Atid will continue doing it, but other parties as well, to create a scenario where Israel remains unified. And of course we'll have disagreements. And of course we'll have different ideologies, but that we'll really feel that we're one people. Many people say to me, and I'll close with this point and then take questions, many people say to me that this vision of mine for unity, they say it's stam chalom, just a dream. You're this naive American, came off the boat 10 years ago, you don't understand the Middle East, Haredim don't really want to change, secular Israelis don't really want to change, we'll have this battle for the next few hundred years and that's the way it's going to be. That's what they say. So when they say it's stam chalom, first of all, after a year and a half, I already see that it's not the case. And I see that there are things that we can do to break down barriers and work together and try to create some unity. But the other thing I think about when they say stam chalom, when they say it's just a dream, I actually think about something that happened 30 years ago. 30 years ago, I was a 13-year-old kid in Silver Spring, and we went a few times to Washington, D.C., just 20 minutes away from my house, to the Soviet embassy to demonstrate on behalf of our brothers and sisters behind the Iron Curtain, and I'm sure many people sitting here were part of those efforts as well. And one of those times was a cold Washington morning, I remember it very clearly. Usually we would sing, Am Yisrael Chai, and we would chant, 1, 2, 3, 4, open up the iron door. And one of those times they gave us signs. It was a silent vigil. And I stood there holding my sign. I read it, I didn't know who he was, but I stood there holding my sign. And my sign said, Free Yuli Edelstein. That was my sign. You want to talk about Stam Chalom? You want to talk about just a dream? David HaMelech says in Tehillim, Shir HaMa'alot B'Shuvah Adonai Shivat Zion Hayinu Kecholmim. The return of the people of Israel to Zion were like dreamers. 30 years later, I'm blessed to sit as a member of the Israeli Knesset, and the speaker of the Knesset is Yuli Edelstein. 30 years ago, I'm this American kid. All I'm thinking about is my sports and whatever else it is, not thinking about Aliyah, not thinking about politics. Yuli is languishing in a prison cell in Siberia. And 30 years later, we're reunited every single day in Yerushalayim, Yir HaKodesh, in the Knesset. So no one's going to tell me that anything is stam chalom. anything is just a dream. We live in unbelievable times. And the founders of the state of Israel were against far greater odds in succeeding in founding this state than we are in making it better. So we are going to continue with our belief that we live in these unbelievable times where we're blessed from above to have our country, to have our land, to have this self-determination where we can deal with the issues as we need to deal with them, and where we have the ability to use the state as a platform to create unity and generate unity among Jews. And God willing, we will be successful, and hopefully all of you can join in that vision as well. And from both sides of the ocean, we can work on creating that unity, which will bring, God willing, the ultimate redemption as well. Thank you so much for your time.
We'll take a few questions. I will seize the prerogative of asking the first question. First of all, I hope that you all have understood the value of Rabbi Lipman's work and the work of Yesh Atid, which I think is nothing less, in my humble opinion, nothing less than revolutionary. And I wish you much, much continued success in all the things that you are doing.
Thank you.
So last year, just about this time, we met at the RCA convention, and the fellow who spoke the evening before you or after you was representing the position more associated with the Aguda, and his criticism was that all the things that you're saying regarding integrating the Haredim into the economy, into national service, etc., they're all happening on their own, and the work that you are doing will only cause, you know, will only set things back 10, 15, 20 years, if not more. So my question to you is, for example, you know, people who were Haredim were serving in the army, they feel they can't sign up in the and that the numbers of enlistment would go significantly down. So my question is, a year later, was this criticism well-founded? Have the Haredim retreated in their military service in all these various areas, or not?
So we knew that when we were passing this legislation that the Haredi political leadership would stir up the Haredi community and the Haredi street, and that would create a setback for a period of time. We knew it beforehand, meaning we knew that was going to happen, that would be the environment, there would be a lot of Pashkevilim, which are these posters all over the community, and then over time, they would realize, wait a minute, we're not arresting the boys, and we're not ruining Torah, and the numbers would start to increase. So we're already at the point where the increase is coming into play. It went down, as we knew it would, but the army is now assessing, and by the way, it's unfortunate, but the war actually played a role in this, where they've had a sudden burst of interest. You know, you're a 20-year-old, 21-year-old guy, and you're not really learning day and night, and you see these funerals coming and boys getting hurt. And by the way, I just want to mention about getting hurt. You know, I visited hospitals, and you're told this boy is Kal. He's hurt lightly, right? Light is just in terms of threat to his life. But you walk into the room and this 20-year-old kid doesn't have his left hand anymore. So he's stable, but he's lightly wounded or has shrapnel up and down his body. So they see this and they say, you know what? There's something which stirs inside of you and maybe I should get involved. So they're actually thinking right now, there's plans for another Givati battalion just for Haredim. That they're planning on building because of the resurgence of interest. We also have definitely seen the numbers in terms of going to work have definitely increased. That's way off the charts. Just one program of ours, we started this website called All Jobs Haredim. All Jobs is the number one employment service in Israel, which a Haredi wouldn't go to because it's sort of a secular website that's out there. So we started one just for Haredim, where the employers said, we want Haredim. And we're getting 500 resumes per month are coming in through that service. So there's no doubt that we saw the decrease, and then now we're slowly getting back to the increase. In terms of it was happening anyway, that's a line which was thrown out there a lot. It was happening just for boys who were outcasts already from the community. Meaning there's different ways of looking at this. Is it boys who are already rebellious in nature and don't want to be part of the Haredi community go and serve. That was happening. But for a mainstream boy to go learn in yeshiva at 18, 19, 20 years old and then say, okay, I've had my 3 or 4 years of learning, I'm not cut out to learn day and night the rest of my life, what's my next step? That wasn't happening. And that's what we're trying to change, and that's God willing what's going to change.
Recently, the UN Human Rights Organization appointed this virulent anti-Israeli Shabbas, a Canadian, as the lead investigator to investigate Israel's actions during the Gaza War. And at the same time, the Palestinians are talking about taking Israel to the World Court, charging it with crimes against humanity or war crimes, whatever the charges may be. So my question is, what are the ramifications to Israel, whether it does or does not subject itself to these two inquiries?
I appreciate the question because it's very easy to say we're not participating with anything without analyzing exactly right. The inclination right now within the government is not to participate with the overall UN probe. Not because of the idea of the probe. That's something which, although it's a farce, we say, okay, we have to participate, but because of the improper selection, meaning on grounds of the selection, not on grounds on how can you possibly be investigating us. So if it was purely, do we cooperate in general, we probably would. But in this particular case, we're using that and saying that we're not, that's where it seems to be headed, but we're being very careful and cautious in terms of what direction to go in. The fact that there's no level of investigation in terms of Hamas, or not even mentioned, that's also part of it. I'll be honest with you, within the Knesset, the issue of the UN is almost a non-factor. What will the UN say? What will the UN do? It's almost wall-to-wall. We understand that it's a joke. The relationship with the United States, not so. That's something which we are very cautious about, and cautious about for a number of reasons, including the fact that we have two new batteries of the Iron Dome coming because of a vote in Congress just 2 weeks ago, which the President signed. So that's something which we do care about, and we have to be more cautious about in general. But with the UN, it's not something which you have this feeling of, oh my goodness, the UN is somehow looking at us in a negative way. That's the way it always is. So my assumption right now, the way things stand, is that there won't be cooperation, but no official decision has been made.
Can this international court I'm sorry, I didn't mention this.
There is an issue, unfortunately, of living in a world where if our leadership, and it's not just the Prime Minister, my son, who is 17 years old and has plans to be a Navy SEAL, right? So he's going to go through his Army experience, and then one day, I don't know, he's going to want to travel somewhere or go somewhere, right? Can he land in England and all of a sudden be arrested for being a member of the Israeli Army? These are real issues. We can't just push it to the side. Again, we're not going to do something which hurts our security for those reasons, but in terms of how to navigate through these difficult challenges, that does play a role for sure. We do have to be cautious because of that issue. And there have been ministers who could not travel to various places for periods of time because of these issues. The question was whether we in Yesh Atid as a party are aware of the Haredi involvement in the initiatives during the war to reach out to the Chayalim and show support and the like. Grassroots, yeah. Let me clarify. I want to step to something else first, then I'll answer your question. Because it's a premise to the question which I want to address. Yesh Atid is not anti the Haredim. There are people in Yesh Atid who meet with Haredim regularly. Regularly. It's done quietly. Very quietly. But I personally meet with Haredim on a daily basis. But other members of the party, on all kinds of issues, The education minister meets with them about education, and the welfare minister is very involved. There's actually been more progress in the Haredi community on welfare issues because of a welfare minister who will sit with them and work with them on abuse issues and other issues which haven't been dealt with because there's somebody who they feel they can speak to. On many, many issues, we work with them, and that's not an issue. No one is anti-Haredi. No one has to be shown that the Haredim are good people. That's in terms of the premise of the question. In terms of are we aware? Yes, we're aware. I actually believe that that's a result of what happened with the legislation. Meaning the Haredim all of a sudden realized, wait a minute, maybe people don't realize that we appreciate the soldiers and the like, and they went out of their way to make very, very public gestures towards the soldiers. I think that broader Israel as a whole will embrace the Haredi community more as a lot of the initiatives. It's not just a question of did your child make a picture with the Chayil, for the Chayilim, which is important. It's important. I'm not in any way saying it's not. But it's, are we one people? Are we in this together? Because what happens is, a secular person, during the war, goes and sees, I'll just give you an example. I stopped to get gas on my way home from the Knesset one night, and there, sitting in a restaurant, there are like 40 guys, right? 18, 19 year olds sitting in the restaurant. So, forget me for a moment, because I know I was in yeshiva, you can have a break, it's okay. But a secular person sees that, knowing that their children, and it doesn't matter if they're a combat soldier or not, they're down there in Gaza, and these guys are sitting in a restaurant. And that's an issue which has to be addressed. And the way to address it is by guys starting to serve. Within Haredi units, no one's going to make them less religious. They can do national service. Our law allows them to do national service. Volunteering for Magen David Adom, volunteering for Zaka, going to a nursing home, as Yair Lapid said during the campaign, and it's on video, he said it in English, at an English event, he said, show me the rabbi who says that he has a problem with his yeshiva student going to volunteer nursing home as his national service, and I will stand up and say, he does not represent our Torah. That's what he said. To go involved, we have all kinds of frameworks. That's where the change really has to come, and it will come. It'll take time, and that's why we made the law the way we made it. It's gradual in nature, it's a process. And this step of them reaching out to the soldiers is an important step in that process, and I think it shows a lot of the internal reflection that's going on. I got a phone call from a mother in B'nai Brak. It was an unknown number, and she wouldn't tell me her name. But she said, thank you. She said, thank you. She has 8 sons, and she says she looks at them, and maybe one, she said, is really cut out to study Torah day and night. She's being honest with herself. And she wants the rest of them to be religious and learn Torah and balance. But right now, she feels the way the culture was, they have to choose. If they want to remain in the Haredi fold, they have to just learn Torah day and night. And if not, then they're out. And they can't find that balance. And she said, you're creating a framework for that balance, and she said, thank you. And that's ultimately the goal. No one wants anybody to be less religious, and nobody is anti the Haredi life, the belief system.
First of all, kol hakavod. As the mother of a daughter who lives with her family all day, and a 15-year-old grandson who will be in the army one day. Thoughts on what's going on in Europe? I don't know, it's a huge subject, it's an old subject, but it's still a new subject. Any thoughts?
Sure. And then we'll take one more question and we'll conclude the evening.
Thank you. And if those who did not ask or have other questions, I'll leave some business cards here. You can definitely be in touch and I will answer those questions. I sit on the Immigration, Absorption, and Diaspora Affairs Committee. And we've read reports about anti-Semitism in Europe where we haven't seen anything yet in terms of what's coming. And the internet, it plays a major role. There's a website and a Facebook page, which is one of the most popular growing pages, the Hitler Revival, that Hitler resurrected, or I forgot the exact terminology. We made a decision as a government, and our committee pushed for it, for a major, major initiative of Aliyah from Europe. Because if you're trying to find a solution, there's no solution. We can get increased security in front of shuls. We can reach out to the members of parliament, and we do. I sit on the Christian Allied Caucus in the Knesset, which means that we work with members of parliament around the world who are Christian, who are strong supporters of Israel, Christians who have addressed the fact that for centuries they were anti-Semitic and now changing their ways. I was in Hungary 2 months ago, and they told me that there's going to be 12,000 supporters of Israel at some event. I was like, 12,000, that's going to happen? And they walked us into this arena, and there were 12,000 Christians waving the Israeli flag and singing Hava Nagila. So we work with members of parliament to try to address legislation about Bris Mila, about Shechita, about issues. But to address anti-Semitism in general, there's almost nothing that we can actually do other than offer opportunities and make it easier for people to come. We are anticipating, especially from France, a huge, huge number. I'm talking about tens of thousands over the next few years. And it's our responsibility as a state, the same way it was done for the Sephardic communities in the 50s and 60s, and the same way for the Russians in the 90s, to really get things ready to enable them to come. And that's the best thing that we could do. So I have no words of hope in terms of the direction of Europe. Yeah, but if it means Jews coming to Israel, I'm very happy with that solution. But yes, it is dangerous. It is a serious situation. And there is nothing simple that we can do on the ground to address it other than to try to create a framework. Again, we pass resolutions in the parliaments, and there's hate crimes, and we'll do all of that, and we'll continue to do all of that. But in terms of, do we have some kind of a solution for the problem? No, and the problem is, without a doubt, based on what we've seen, polls that have been done in country after country, and we read the results, the anti-Semitism is very, very strong. It's very, very dangerous in terms of the way people will speak about Jews there. And therefore, we as an Israel, it's our responsibility to bring them, to Israel, where we can provide them with sanctuary. That's the goal.
Take one question over here.
You mentioned earlier that there are that you agree with Yair Lapid 80% of the time and 20% of the time. I don't agree with him. But I was wondering his position vis-a-vis Yehudah Shomron and giving up territory is a bit disturbing, so I want to know where you stand on that. And also, sorry, a comment. We have a son who currently serves in the IDF. He's in Natsa Yehuda. And we were in the base on Matzah Pesach, and it was such a wonderful environment in terms of the Torah aspect of the shuls. I just wonder why not more has Baraz been done with the Haredi community to give them tours of what it's like to be in Nahal Haredi, and that's something you do especially. It's a wonderful environment.
Thank you for the question. I'll address both of them. If I forget the second one, just remind me, because sometimes it's hard to hold a thought. In terms of Yehuda Shomron, yes, I do agree. Let me just explain what the ideology is. The starting point is that Yehuda and Shomron are part of Israel, they're part of biblical Israel, and even the thought of parting with any part of the land of Israel is very, very painful, and one which would not be done unless it was somehow in Israel's best interest to do so. That's where we define ourselves as not left, where there seems to be a rush, you know, just get a piece of paper that says we have peace. Yair actually is refusing to even say peace with the Palestinians. He says some kind of an arrangement, but it's never going to be some kind of a warm and fuzzy peace with them. What we've said is that if we can create a scenario where there is an internationally backed agreement which provides for Israel's security on Israel's terms, then that would mean that we would have to part with parts of the land which are very dear to us. If we did so, we would have to do so only after we've already taken care of the living arrangements and the like for any people who are going to ask. The people who are asked to move have to be dealt with like heroes for doing so, and not, unfortunately, the way the people from Gaza, who are still, by the way, not totally housed, were dealt with. We as a party believe that Yerushalayim is not negotiable. As Yair says, Yerushalayim is not just a place, it's an idea. We returned after 2,000 years. We didn't return to the Azrieli Towers, we returned to the Towers of David in Jerusalem. These are his quotes, not mine. And these are things which I subscribe to. For those who say we will never do so, we will never do so, then the question has to be asked the other way. So what is your plan? I don't mean you. What is their plan for a few million Palestinians who live under our control that don't have full rights as citizens? And that's a very difficult challenge. You know, it was easy for me before I was in a decision-making seat to say certain things, right? But then, okay, but now I'm a member of a parliament right now of a country, of a state, which has a few million people who are not given their full rights. Now, what do you do about it? So our idea is, we call it the separating from the Palestinians, right? And obviously try geographically to hold on to as much as we can, and for sure not to forego on our security at all. But that's the way we see the idea of trying to balance the two. We believe that it's possible. I'm not gonna say that it's likely. An overwhelming majority of Israelis believe in the two-state solution as a solution. An overwhelming majority don't believe it's going to happen, which is just very instructive in terms of where Israel is. But we absolutely can never say that we're not moving forward with any kind of a solution at all. That's a mistake of historic proportions for Israel to do. What we have to do is something, as a people are living in our borders, and we have to find some kind of, so that's our proposed solution to deal with the crisis. There is, by the way, a little bit of an opportunity with the Gaza situation to possibly use sort of this ally situation with Egypt and Saudi Arabia to actually get even more Palestinian Authority influence in Gaza. We'll see if it's possible. Again, it's a utopian situation. It's possible. It's possible that enough leverage can be used. In terms of Netzach Yehuda, the Nahal Haredi, first of all, I'm happy, I'm proud that you have a son that's unbelievable that's doing so. And it is a remarkable program. One of the boys told me, I love this line. He said, if I was in yeshiva and didn't show up for davening, nothing happens. If I don't show up for davening in army, I get thrown out of the program. It's an interesting dynamic to think about. There was part of the law that we had to pull out of the law, unfortunately. At the moment, there was part of the law which was that every Haredi boy, when he turns 18 and he goes to the army to then say, I'm going to learn for the next few years, whatever it was, that they would have to go through some level of exposure to all the programs that are available to them. Meaning, before they say, that's it, we're just going to yeshiva, to actually see Nahal Haredi, to see Shachar Kachol in the Air Force, to see all the different options. Politics made us pull that back. It gets into some of the coalition politics, but the Haredi party's got the prime minister to pull it back. So it's not in the in the current law. It has to happen by word of mouth. That's the way the Haredi community works. The more things are out there, even the rabbi asked the question, right? The law was out there, so there's immediately a lot of noise against it. If we were out there making a lot of noise about Nahal Haredi and Netzach Yehuda, then there would be a lot of noise against it. And right now, there's really no noise against it, and we'd rather it be that way. That as boys make the decision that they want to serve, that they might choose the Nahal Haredi. It's an interesting balance that we have to make. That the worst thing for us right now, and for the progress in the army, and for the boys at Nahal Haredi, would be for anybody to be out there speaking against it. And right now, they're not speaking against it. They're not pushing boys to it. But they're not speaking out against it. That enables us to have this framework where, as we meet these goals per year, that the boys can join the Nahal Haredi. And I happen to agree with you. I think it's one of the pride and joys of Israel. Pride of Israel is to see these young men who are so committed, who demanded that they be more involved in combat situations, and have been giving more and more as they have shown what unbelievable soldiers they are. And God willing, that trend will continue. And may all of us just share good news together. If anybody didn't ask a question, I'll leave some business cards here. And we should all, like I said, share good occasions together. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Haver Knesset, Rabbi Litvin, for being with us. We hope to have you back again in the near future or in the future as your schedule allows. And at this point, we're going to Daven Maariv in just a couple of moments. So we ask if there are women that are remaining for davening to daven in the women's section, if there are men who are remaining to stay in the men's section.